Hello and welcome to the Cinematologist Podcast. I'm Dario Linares, and with me, of course, is my good friend and colleague, Neil Fox. Neil, how are you doing?
I'm really well, Dario. You're doing really well as well, haven't you? You've had a bit of a week, retweeted by Marc Maron and featured in a really, really fascinating new video essay on kind of voiceover and in film criticism online.
Yeah, I wrote this blog about podcasting versus radio. I was watching. I was kind of being off six though with my shoulder. I was kind of watching a bit of the Maron TV show, and there was this one particular episode that really sort of intrigued me and sort of caught my imagination, because it spoke to the relationship between podcasting as a medium and how it is indebted to, but also there's a kind of antagonism between the people who are proponents of radio and podcasters. And it obviously speaks a lot to the research that we've been doing with the podcast, but also with our disruptive media episode. So I wrote this blog out, and as you do, I kind of linked on social media, on Twitter, to Marc Maron. You know, with social media, these things are kind of common practice, and sometimes nothing happens and sometimes it does. But Marc Maron actually retweeted and said he enjoyed reading it.
Yeah, he said it was a thoughtful piece, which I thought was gave a sense that he'd read it. And I mentioned it to someone yesterday, and they sort of said, well, it is a community, isn't it? You know, even on his podcast, talking about kind of being at podcast conventions and stuff, I think he feels very connected to the podcast world. He knows that's how people know him. So it's that was really nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a nice gesture, isn't it? And I think it sort of also speaks to that idea of moving outside of academia and finding ways in which, you know, academic research and research that would probably ordinarily sit just behind, you know, the traditional silos, in, you know, if you're interested in open source publishing and ways of disseminating research in non-traditional forms, then I know some people could say, oh, this is just celebrity culture, but the hit on my website was over 500. So there's 500 people who have read a blog that probably would never have read it, was it not for that retweet. And then yeah, I had another link through Twitter from a guy who has just finished this audio visual essay, and it was about the voice in visual essays and the use of the voiceover, and he linked again to a blog that I'd written about the use of the voice in podcasting, as listeners will know, and as you know, I'm not the biggest fan of my own accent when it comes to listening back and editing the podcast. It's something I've had to kind of get over.
I got told by yesterday by someone who I met recently. His name's Adrian, and his partner's just come to work as the head of TV at the School of Film and Television. And he said that he thought I had a very gentle voice, which I took as a real compliment. So yeah, I think you're right. We are very aware of a lot of the things that essay brought up about, you know, not just the academic voice, but academic tone and how we write the podcast and what, you know. So I thought it was a really interesting piece. And yeah, it was, so yeah, double chuffed to see you getting some kudos this week.
So that video essay was made by Ian Garwood, and it's called The Place of Voiceover in Academic Audiovisual Film and Television Criticism. So we'll put a link to that up on the website. Yeah, and the other thing I just wanted to mention before we sort of get onto today's show was just the support we've had this season from our audience. And we don't have a big marketing strategy or plan or budget or anything like that. Everything we do goes through social media. And I think it's always reliant on the audience believing in the program and downloading it, but also curating it by retweeting it and recommending it on their networks and to their friends. So our continued growth, I think we've put on 2,000 new subscribers since the Before Sunrise episode. You know, so we're continuing to grow, which is a great thing, because it just does give you that impetus to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think alongside the kind of that number has been more and more conversation, particularly on social media, around episodes and around kind of the content going out. So it's been, yeah, it's been a really encouraging few months all round. Yeah.
Indeed. So today's show is very much in your wheelhouse, as it were, in terms of you recording and stuff. But it's very much areas that we're both interested in terms of documentary and in terms of the current political climate, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit today.
Yeah. So after that positive opening, maybe we'll be talking a little bit in a little bit kind of darker and more depressing terms. The film that we screened this time out was D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hedges's The War Room, which was actually picked by Kingsley, and he's published on American Presidents, so in kind of cinema, particularly kind of Nixon and George W. Bush. And he was, he kind of thought it'd be good timing with the election. And it was funny because we just talked about screening this exact film around that time as well, so it felt like the right time to screen it. And we hadn't done a kind of, you know, what you might call a traditional documentary. I say that term because obviously the last time we showed a doc was the Nick Cave film, which is very, very elastic, much more elastic, I think, than this film. So we screened The War Room a few days after the events of the American election.
Yeah, that's right. And you guys get into it quite a bit in terms of both of those subject areas. And obviously the War Room is about the Clinton administration, the first Clinton administration. So Bill Clinton coming to become president and the mechanics behind that, which obviously you get into. And then you have an interview with a filmmaker who has just released a new film called The Hard Stop.
Yeah, I spoke to George Amponsar, who is the director and producer of The Hard Stop, which is a film about the killing of Mark Duggan and the events that spiraled out of that, both in the vicinity of Tottenham and in the kind of the inquest into his death. And it's interesting, obviously, that there was a film on the BBC last night. I think it was called Lawful Killing, which kind of investigated the same thing. But the reason I wanted to talk to him, because kind of seeing bits of the film, it was clear that this was someone who was coming at it from a kind of filmmaking sensibility, was trying to use the form in those kind of cinematic ways that observational documentary is kind of renowned for, in order to kind of, you know, to paint broader pictures of the kind of context of the lives involved, rather than just kind of a polemical piece of fact or fiction. So it was really, it was a real thrill to talk to him. He is a very knowledgeable and astute filmmaker. So hopefully people will, we'll get something out of that.
Absolutely. And I think also it ties in beautifully with The War Room, because they're both observational documentaries, which is this particular strand of documentary which seeks to withdraw the directorial intervention. But in doing that, that is a directorial intervention, kind of ironically. So maybe we'll get into that kind of idea of what the observational doc offers and why perhaps it's going through a little bit of a renaissance right now.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting as well to see a doc like The Hard Stop in the context of The War Room, when a lot of the talk around documentary is much more about kind of subjective experimental kind of techniques. So it was not refreshing, because I, you know, love some of that work, like Guzman's work and Oppenheimer's work, but it was a kind of a nice refreshing blast to see someone taking that form to approach this subject.
So let's get on to the introduction now. This is Neil and Kingsley introducing The War Room.
Good evening, welcome to The Cinematologists. It's good to be back. I'm Neil Fox, and with me is Kingsley. Hello, Kingsley.
Hello, Neil.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
Good. Tonight we are screening D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hedges's The War Room, which is their 1992 documentary about the US presidential election.
I picked this one.
You did?
Yeah, I thought it'd be timely. I didn't expect when I picked it, which is about 3 months ago, that we'd be in the position we're in today. I feel strange about it.
So, in 300 years, the aliens find the box that contains the internet, and they listen to this podcast, and this is a time capsule. So where are we? How do you feel about what's going on in the world and what's happened the last couple of weeks?
Well, I've written a little bit about the US presidency, and I'm kind of interested in that, and I've been interested in the US presidency for a long time, and I'm really interested in the US election process and presidential candidates, and I've read a lot about successful presidential candidates and losers as well. There's a great Michael Lewis book called Losers, which is about people who run for the presidency and don't achieve that position. It's really informative about the kind of people who run and why they run. And there's always a Donald J. Trump kind of character as part of that process, and there's often someone like a Hillary Clinton, you know. But I think what it says to me, the day afterwards, I came into the university and I was teaching and my class were on their phones and, you know, on computers and things. And I was a bit mean to them in that I said, that's democracy, suck it up. Because it is democracy, and someone's won, and it's an expression of something, but ultimately someone's won, and we have a president-elect, and now it's about what we do after that moment. And I think there's many interesting ways of thinking about that. So an element of it is I'm processing what's happened. I didn't vote in that election, obviously. I'm not a US citizen, so I can't. My parents are there, which is interesting to me. They live in California. I think, what are we, 3 or 4 weeks out? 3 weeks out from that moment. And we're seeing some interesting uses of social media and a domination of the discussion. And I think, as someone who's interested in the media and mediation of politics, that Trump is running rings around the usual processes of a president-elect and transition. So, yeah, I'm kind of in a interesting mood, I think. And I think it's interesting to see what will happen over the next, certainly next few months. And I think it will settle, but it'd be interesting to see what happens in the next 4 years or so. Well, what are your feelings?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It wasn't really a surprise, you know. Like, I think if you're engaged with the world, I mean, you know, in the last couple of years, we've had a lot of those kind of moments where there's this kind of shock that something's happened, but really the world has kind of been going that way. And I think that the same players are involved, but how they finish has changed a lot. And a lot of it's very scary, but a lot of it's very scary in terms of our access to images and kind of and to news that we wouldn't have had, you know, kind of 10, 20 years ago. But that's the stuff that really scares me. You know, the stuff that Trump doesn't scares me. It's just that it's what these kind of moments, and to be, and it feels very similar to Brexit. You know, I don't feel there's any difference. You know, I think we've gone through this. You know, this surge of hate and the liberation of certain kind of people's ideas is in the wake has just been really kind of sickening. That's quite sickening. But because we've already kind of been through that with Brexit, I spent the next couple of days thinking, well, what can I do? Do you know what I mean? Like, what can I do? What's my role in this? You know, because being on Twitter and retweeting that Trump's bad just seems pathetic. But I'm interested in politics. I read a lot about politics, and I know that stuff. I didn't learn anything from that election, and I think. But that's the thing: is what have I done with the knowledge, and what am I doing on a day-to-day basis to kind of fight those things which are now gaining momentum again in my own way? And that's why I thought it was great that we were screening the film today, because it's like, well, what. I'm involved in cinema in various ways. I don't want to use it as a kind of just a pure escapism thing. I want it to have a purpose. I don't think that purpose is necessarily changing the world. And I wanted to sort of ask you what you thought about a film like this, and what is the purpose of documentary and cinema? Because obviously we know it's not going to change the world, but what can it do? What should it do? You know.
Well, that's why I chose it, actually. And that part of it, it's about the Clinton campaign, Bill Clinton campaign rather than Hillary. But I chose it because I'm still interested in it, about dynasties in the US presidency. And I thought, I don't know how I'd feel about Hillary Clinton as president-elect either. And that's why I thought it was an interesting thing to screen, because what Hillary's campaign made you think about was Bill Clinton. And it made you think about that presidency and about legacy. And I'm really interested in the legacy of presidencies. I've written a little bit about presidential temples, presidential libraries, and kind of Nixon's legacy. And I'd written previously about the Bush dynasty and how uncomfortable I was about Oliver Stone's fictional representation of those things. I think what's interesting about this movie, which I've watched quite a few times, I've seen it a few times, I'm going to watch it again tonight, is that it's revelatory, because what you see is it's like the Wizard of Oz. You peek behind the curtain of a campaign, and what you see is young people and enthusiastic people. And it's not just that they represent Democrats or the left. It's not about that. It's about a passion and an engagement in politics. And of course, the presidency is interesting because it's spectacular, and it is spectacular, and it is astonishing, particularly in the States, it's a long presidential run. And I think as a doc, it reveals this mechanism of state and of power and projected power, particularly in the US presidency. But shows you that the people behind it are just like you and I. You know, they're very smart people in this campaign, and you see that. And this movie is a kind of a buddy movie and things. But it does what a lot of presidential biopics can't do, because this is shot before the filmmakers know who's going to win. It's a campaign, and anything can happen. And if they were filming now, they'd kind of be in a very different position, wouldn't they? But there's also something about, when I rewatch it, I'm watching it through the benefit of hindsight and thinking what great potential Bill Clinton held in my view, and I remember that of the time. But also 20 years later, the disappointment and the legacy of that presidency. And what I've written about in the past with movies is about Nixon and what happens to the US presidency after that moment, and how history kind of thinks about that, and how Nixon is represented and re-represented in culture. And I think it's immensely powerful. Mm. What's interesting to watch it tonight is to think about the Trump presidency and the campaign, and how we are seeing the mechanisms of this stuff immediately live, with Trump on his phone, presumably, or whatever, tweeting the way he feels in that moment. And to me, as someone who grew up in the 70s and 80s, that's unknown, you know, and it's hard to compute. And you start to think about the power of social media and the power of the internet and the access we have to people in all sorts of positions and people's thoughts, processes, and those kind of things. So I think, you know, clearly we believe that cinematic form, whether documentary or fiction narrative film, is immensely powerful. And I think this film is powerful because it gives me access, in part, not to the president, funnily enough, but to everybody around him. And then you start to understand the political, the machinery of it. And I think post US election 2016, you realise you can invest billions, and it is billions of dollars, and have incredibly smart people around you and crunch the numbers. And I'd read a lot in the run-up to the 2016 election about the kind of management of campaign information and kind of voters and things, and still be wrong. And that's what's lovely about this film, is it's pregnant with possibility. Mm. You don't know how it's going to go. And how you engage with that as a member of the audience is kind of fascinating, I think. So I think that, you know, this kind of media is powerful. And what I love about this film is it's from about 40 hours of footage. They don't have much access to Clinton himself. But it says something about how exciting this is. Mm. And the potential of it, Neil, is just, to me, astonishing. Yeah. It is, America remains a superpower. And the presidency is this almost mythical, but it's a person,
yeah,
with people around them. And I find that almost emancipatory. It is emancipatory, right? Particularly in America.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I'm reading Keith Beattie's book on Don't Look Back, which the BFI have just released. So reading a lot about, you know, Pennybaker on that. And it's interesting because all those things you're sort of saying about this film are kind of present in that, and which kind of makes me, reminds me of the just the great filmmakers that they are, you know, that ability to capture that moment and be able to construct such a kind of deep and long-lasting story around this myth. And obviously Dylan in 64, 65 is a myth, and is cultivating that myth in the same way that a president cultivates a myth. And I think what the great thing about Pennybaker and Hedges' work is that they're deeply interested in the people, but also understanding that these people are part of a bigger machine, and they're able to kind of capture both in the same place, which obviously means that regardless of the outcome of the 1992 election, this film remains interesting because it's made by filmmakers. And I think that's why I think cinema is still so important, is because there are filmmakers, and as a form, it gives us an insight that is kind of deeply human, and also sets a marker in the sand and says, you know, don't forget what happened here. And, you know, just kind of builds up this almost critical mass of information and ideas that at some point we're going to we're going to need, you know.
There's something about mediation as well. That there's a great book called The Selling of a President, which is about Nixon's campaign having lost to Kennedy in a previous election. And just at that moment, that book really captures a very thin book, but really interesting about how television media in the States becomes massively important to the presidential run. And we're seeing in this election, it's about television. In the recent election, 2016 election, it's about something bigger than that, media. And I wonder now, I mean, thinking about how I feel about it at the moment, I kind of feel differently about mass media, I think, and about the enormous power of Facebook and other social media, Twitter, but particularly Facebook. And the global nature and reach of that is astonishing. And I think, but what's covered in this documentary and what's written about in The Selling of the President, they're the same things, which is about how we invest in image and message. And it seems so reductive. And I felt that post-Brexit, how I feel about it doesn't matter, but that the messaging of it became reductive and then dismissed almost immediately. And it's something to do with the 24-hour cycle of news, which is now a five-minute cycle of news, that the Trump-Hamilton story, which is broken in the last few days, says something about the power of social media over news media. And that's why this film becomes important, because it's about a moment, but it's still as insightful about a kind of, it's not even manipulation, I don't think it's that. And there are scenes in this film which are about a manipulation of an audience, but I don't think it's about that. I think it's about getting your message across and how you do that. And I think that in a film or TV school, that's really important in everything that we do and that we make. And this film speaks to so many facets of mediated power, I guess.
Great place to kick off the screening. So let's settle in for Penn and Baker and Hedges' The War Room.
In the 1960s, D.A. Pennybaker's Don't Look Back and Monterey Pop captured the legends of rock and roll. Now, D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus bring us the making of the first president from the rock and roll generation.
Somebody who's been through a lot of tough elections, James Carville, is known as the Raging Cajun in the business.
So let me tell you what's at stake in this election.
It's about George Bush and the whole sleazy little cabal of them. You're going to get tax breaks for the wealthy. You're going to get a guy that doesn't know what a grocery store scanner is.
I'm getting sick and tired. I am every single night hearing one of these carping little liberal Democrats jumping all over my you-know-what.
I'm George Stephanopoulos. I'm director of communications.
Bush was on the defensive. Another good night for Bill Clinton. Three debates. Three wins.
I guarantee you that if you do this, you'll never work in Democratic politics again.
If we cannot believe anything he has said about his past, how can we believe anything he's saying about the future?
Well, I think Mary Mallon's got a good career in fiction writing when this is over.
I'm lost. I don't know where I'm supposed to go next.
Turn Perot off. I don't want to look at it.
How are you? Nice to see you.
Stay focused. Talk about things that matter to people.
We love Hillary's new patriotism thing.
It's the economy, stupid.
Speak from your heart tonight. I mean, that's all that matters.
Read my lips.
Just the most famous broken promise in the history of American politics.
Let them spend. We will win.
He is so yesterday, if I think of an old calendar, I think of George Bush's face on it.
Woo! Landslide.
I like the way this thing feels.
They change the way campaigns are won. The War Room, from D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus.
This is just the most American thing you can do.
So as you can tell there, the tone was quite somber, and we were just very much still processing what the world felt like in that period afterwards. What did you sort of make of what we were talking about there, and how did that kind of relate to what you were kind of going through?
No, I was going through exactly the same thing, and I'm still kind of like processing, because it's interesting how Brexit the vote has happened and Trump the vote has happened, but neither of them have happened in reality. So there's this kind of purgatory that we're in right now, waiting for the actual full effects of these, of what is going to happen in the aftermath of these decisions. And you know, Kingsley sort of said at one point quite early on when he says to the students, you know, that's democracy, just suck it up, which, you know, on the one hand is right, but it's also usually problematic when you think about the ways in which the structures of democracy are organized or their their imperfections in terms of their organization. And the idea that democracy is a sort of universal given that operates in this kind of neutral ways is really not right. And if anything, the war room and what we've seen about the way that news and information has been spread and managed and influenced and corrupted in myriad different ways, and the way, like, say, for example, the James Comey announcement about the emails, you know, a week before the vote. I mean, I'm still of the view that probably tipped it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? There's almost a separation in the idea of democracy between result and process, as if once the result is announced, that's democracy. But what leads up to that decision and what garners that response from the electorate, it can be thoroughly undemocratic. So, you know, what are we really talking about when we talk about democracy? And I think that's why The War Room is such an interesting film in the light of what's happened with Trump, because you start to see how the process is managed in fundamentally undemocratic ways a lot of the time, you know, in terms of how we then perceive democracy at the end, when it's the voice of the people and the people's understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's interesting how Stephanopoulos and Carville are moaning about the sort of misinformation that's spread out by, you know, and the Democrats do it as well. But, you know, you could argue not to the same kind of degree. And it's really interesting now, obviously, that we've got to a point where these stories coming out of Russia, where there's this little town that is just basically populated by people creating fake Facebook accounts to spread misinformation. And, you know, I've started writing another blog about this idea of the ecosystem of social media and the spreading of fake news, and how this is sort of like the end point or the culmination of postmodernism. You know, this idea now that anything can be said, and also something can be said, it can be on tape, and then at a later date can be completely denied, and nobody will connect the dots to say, well, actually, you could argue the electorate don't connect the dots to be able to say, well, he's saying this thing here, and then he's totally denying it here. It's kind of like anything kind of goes when it comes to information now.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we might sort of, I think we're going to talk about this, aren't we, in terms of like what role can documentaries play. But, and I was talking to Kingsley about 13th, and I know we both really like that film. And what was especially powerful to me was how it put all these events in a line in a way that you couldn't deny this kind of systematic build-up of factors, you know. And it kind of took a step back and, yeah, kind of created a timeline that was just so undeniable. But that was a film that couldn't get into the conversation really in any big way because of the way it was structured. It was slow, it's deliberate, and it's looking at what might, you know, this kind of massive information. We live in the age of big data, but that was a kind of massive historical data that was just kind of too big for people to consume. So it becomes about, like you say, these moments, which can then be absolutely denied in the next moment. But there is the hope, I guess, that some of this will be processed at some point and someone will come along, you know, in that kind of Pennebaker way or in the way that DuVernay did and help us at least see it all in one place and kind of get some kind of grip on it where we can start to talk about it in useful terms, I guess.
To be honest, that's kind of the extent of what we can hope for, really, I think, because the idea that documentaries would have a kind of wider political effect is really, you know, not backed up by any evidence. I mean, if you look at films like Snowden and WikiLeaks, you know, there's a lot of films that are around the idea of surveillance and technological oppression, or that are set up by within law, but also within the ways that governments are kind of acting with impunity. And then, you know, yesterday was one of the biggest surveillance legislations, was kind of surreptitiously put through. Was it yesterday or the day before in the UK? So where again now, you know, the UK seems to be trying to get to the top of the charts in surveilling its own people. But then, you know, you look at Michael Moore's film about Trump that he released just before the election, which obviously was designed to have some kind of, you know, momentum building impact, but obviously had no impact whatsoever. And just moving away from documentary, a film like I, Daniel Blake is obviously highlighting a specific political agenda around poverty, and it has been it has been influential, let's say, in the kind of cultural discourse, but it seems to be, again, confined to a particular set of people who are ready to talk about that anyway. I mean, I, Daniel Blake, is not going to be debated in Parliament like Cathy Come Home was. So the question remains, you know, does cinema ever really influence politics in a direct way? It's very difficult to say that, but it seems that they are appreciated in their own context, but then the relationship to what is actually going on in the world is very ambivalent, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think that, and we kind of touched on this, but it's almost a kind of a smaller, more personal impact. It's the encouragement that a filmmaker like DuVernay, coming off the back of Selma, would make her next move a very political, very direct documentary. That the Loach, for all of his kind of cinematic foibles, is out there fighting this fight still. You know that they're, and the same with the Hard Stop. You know that George Avantaras has spent, however, 6 years, 4 years, sorry. You know, and was prepared to spend all this time, you know, to tell these kind of stories. Those kind of small acts of resistance and activism are kind of vital, even if the reality and in our hearts we know that the impact of this stuff is going to be very minimal in any kind of real sense. I think it is important that people are out there, not going quietly, you know, and not saying that just because democracy has decided that we're going to let it stand. And it doesn't seem like a lot when you're in that kind of moment, but it, what else is there really?
And I think it is important on a micro level, you know, like you're saying, the idea that and whoever it might be, you know, that cinemas and film institutions and film festivals are showing this stuff does have a place out there to create the conversation. And I think maybe, interestingly, having watched a lot of the Iranian films recently, the Jaffa Panahi and the Kiarostami and Makhmal Bath stuff, cinema is like, it's a currency, it's a political currency there. You can get killed for making movies. And I think that sometimes we have to recognise that governments don't like to be portrayed in a negative way. And it certainly is... It has still, I think, a currency that perhaps is not recognised as much as it should be. You can just tell, you know, anecdotally, by the amount of documentaries you get on Netflix means that people are interested in documentary as a form, but also in filmmaking that has a political or social aim within it. I think
the form needs people who believe that what they do is going to register on some level with someone in some way. Otherwise, the work wouldn't work. You know, it wouldn't. You know, you need people to go into those endeavors with that mindset. You know, and I think what's interesting is that, you know, we both had this response, which was, "What can I do? What am I doing?" And then I thought, well, I've spent my whole life dedicating it to cinema, so I have to find a way to do this because I don't want to be someone who just kind of jumps into another arena. I've got this groundswell of work, and I can shift direction within that quite considerably. But this is something that I believe in, and I dedicate my life to, and I have to find a way to merge that with what I believe is right. But I certainly don't want to be one of those people who just kind of spouts off at all this stuff, and when really that's not what I know. It's not what I believe in. So it's seeing the War Room was a kind of reminder of, yeah, actually, like, there's. You can resist, and you can make a film that's deeply ingrained in a specific system and still retain a sense of self and be political and make a number of points which add to a really, really important conversation.
Yeah, and I mean, I was listening to the Waking Up podcast. I don't know if you've heard of that, Neil. It's by a guy called Sam Harris, who's quite a controversial figure. He's like one of the sort of new atheists, as it were. But he said something really interesting in the wake of Trump, because he's virulently kind of anti-Trump, but also, you know, anti-Trump in the sense of being anti this idea that facts are now this ideological football. And he was saying that, you know, in the wake of the Trump election and then all the blogging and all the social media outcry that goes with that, his response has been to kind of like, oh, do you know what? I just want to move on to something else, because as soon as I tweet anything, then you get the complete... ideologues on both sides, so the right-wing pro-Trumpers and then the kind of left-wing. So if you're somewhere in the middle who's trying to find a nuanced position, then you're open to attack from both positions, you know what I mean? And that's kind of really sort of chimed with what I felt. It was like, there's no way I'm going to write a blog on Trump, but I am going to try and write something on this idea of fake news as that kind of contribution. And it speaks a little bit to to what you're talking about, that really, when you think about it, I mean, if you think of something like Brexit and the figures around that, you know, they talk about this 52-48% split. But really, you know, the turnout was extraordinarily low. Was it sort of something like 40% or 45%?
If that, yeah.
So therefore, then the actual percentage of the country who are voting for Brexit is down in the 20s, really.
And the same with Trump. I mean, 20% of Americans vote for Trump.
Exactly. So you know, there's a whole swathe of the country that isn't even engaged to begin with, right? And I think that that is an indictment of the way that the media and politicians and academics and everyone is implicated in not being able to articulate, you know, what is going on in the world in a way that brings enough people in.
Yeah, it's just I felt like it's just this noise. What's the point of me retweeting or saying anything? It's adding to this cacophony, and it makes no difference because of the way that all the outlets are constructed, you know. And I realize, yeah, that the difference I can make is to almost take a step back and commit to a different way of thinking and a different way of talking about things on a more one-to-one basis, where not that I'm going to change people's minds, but where I can feel an engagement and a way through that's more personal. And I think on one of the Dana Carvey on, you know, Mark Maron sort of saying that, you know, the social media is what's going to kill the planet. You know, it's become, and I know that's hyperbolic, but when you're in it, you kind of feel like, where can it go but just utterly destroy itself? And what does that mean? And it does feel almost like that kind of apocalyptic movie where we're walking this wasteland afterwards, reconnecting face to face, because it's become this kind of really horrible virus.
No, but I mean, I do worry about the effect that social media has in that sense of, you know, sort of completely undermining the ideal of what the internet was supposed to provide in terms of a public sphere where, you know, person-to-person networking was going to allow these kind of conversations to happen. But yet now it seems like the anonymity of the internet has just allowed people of all stripes to be able to hide behind an avatar and then spew out all the bile that they feel without any kind of reaction to it, really. When has
a utopian ideal ever been realized? Not been corrupted?
Yes, that's true. So therefore, I think that actually, again, part of it is not to just say, oh, well, you know, I've had thoughts of like ditching Facebook and all that kind of thing. But like I say, you know, just in our little sphere of the podcast, it really has helped and build an audience and build our conversation. So, you know, it's finding a way of, I mean, again, that word curation is a key thing. And I think that the internet is going to have to look for ways in which curation could do a better job rather than just finding these very commercialistic types of algorithms that are looking for us to spend in certain types of ways. I don't know what the answer to that is. I'm not, you know, in that area enough, but.
Well, I think it's how you use any medium, isn't it? You know, I was talking to some people online about this, you know, in terms of the Sight and Sound poll, which was released, you know, and this idea of what films should be discussed. Should it be films released in 2016? And there seemed to be a sense that people thought there was a kind of a film community, you know, and I think that there are little pockets of film communities, but that kind of group of writers in there, you know, you can't engage with those people online. They'll engage with other people who write for Sight and Sound. It's very difficult because there's so much going on. It is these kind of niche communities, and everyone's trying to find a little bit of humanity and a little bit of kind of soul within that. And I think we've been very fortunate with the podcast to find, you know, people who are just really interesting and fun and kind of thoughtful to engage with. And I think that is rare, but that's one thing that we really value and that we really appreciate with kind of social media and something, you know. And it's interesting because, you know, I think our answer is a lot of the time just to kind of keep doing what we're doing. You know, we're growing, more people are coming on board. It might take longer because, and I think it was interesting, you know, having conversations about the type of films we screen, because we had a very low turnout for The War Room, despite it being a few days after Trump and everybody on campus talking about this. And rather than coming together for the film and talking that stuff through, they stayed on their phones, you know. But should we then just show commercial stuff so we get more people, or do we want those people in the room who actually want to engage with that stuff and then build slower? And I know what camp I'm in, and I think that, you know, as you raised at the start, that our commitment to speak, you know, kind of the films that we show and the way we talk about them is garnering the right kind of response and is almost kind of positive antidote to, you know, some of the kind of harsher realities of being online.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And yeah, there's no way that I want to, dumb down's not the right word, but kind of compromise our film selections just because we want to get 50 people in a room. You know, I'd rather have 12 people in a room who all want to say something about this movie. But, you know, in general, that tends to be what happens. But I think it's important as well, we do put popular movie in here and there, because that is part of the conversation too. So
absolutely, and I think those people who listen to our next episode will see that we've done just that, but more on that later.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. Anyway, talking about thoughtfulness and a sort of sensitivity to a subject, I think those words are very much words that can be used to describe the film that obviously was under discussion with your interview coming up.
Yeah, so let's go now into my chat with the director of The Hard Stop, George Amponsar.
Sierra Oscar 6, go ahead.
Sierra Oscar 5, and Sierra Oscar 5, target vehicle just passed through, should be with you in about a minute.
My view towards the police scheme was always, I hated them.
The ones that think they can use their power to intimidate you just because they've got that uniform, and do you know what? You don't intimidate me.
29-year-old Mark Duggan was shot by police in Tottenham. His death sparked riots which spread across the country.
Mark's not that guy that has shootouts.
And he was just trying to find a way out, just like everybody is. And he just never made it.
She said to me today, and it broke my heart, she said, "Mummy, I'm tired." I said, "Go to sleep upstairs in your room." She said, "No, I want to go sleep with my daddy in heaven."
You know, everyone in life has their set date when they're gonna die. Mark's death and the whole anger that it created in me, I got drawn back in.
You're trying to say that Mark's orchestrated the riot, you get what I'm saying?
We never planned to riot, but through frustration, it's just turned that way.
I've lost it.
The jury found that he had no gun in his hand, and yet he was gunned down.
They're telling us it's lawful killing.
You put two bullets in him.
To an unarmed man, justify that action, taking a life that shouldn't have been taken. It's our brother.
Thanks for joining us, George.
My pleasure.
It's really good to talk to you. We've spoken before, and I hope you sort of realise from before and from now that, you know, I think The Hard Stop is a really, I think it's an important film, not just because of the content, but also for the way it kind of almost re-energizes cinematic observational documentary, you know, and I think it's a really kind of potent film visually as well as kind of thematically. It's really interesting kind of the way that the film feels like you started shooting almost kind of as the incidents happened, but I know that's not how it works. So I just wondered how you sort of came to start making the film and when you sort of realized that you wanted to make a film about what happened to Mark Duggan, and how you kind of got to the point of making the film about Marcus and Curtis.
Well, all of that happened organically, and it's quite, I suppose, encouraging to hear you say there's a feeling that the film sort of starts immediately with the events which, you know, began with Mark Duggan being shot whilst being arrested in Tottenham. And, this, you know, 2 days later, the subsequent disturbances that began in Tottenham, which, as we know, then spread across London and then across the cities in across England. And, you know, we actually started filming a year after those events with Marcus and Curtis. And at that time, as you may recall, you know, a lot of people had sort of been arrested sort of in the aftermath of the riots. And I sort of fortuitously found myself with access to actually someone who I guess was being, in many ways, was being accused of being the person who started it all, who actually was, it seemed, one of the last people to be arrested. Because, you know, in their wisdom, the police, I think, left the people in Tottenham at the sort of, you know, the epicentre, if you like, of the riots.
Yeah.
Till last, you know, in terms of their sort of, you know, post-riot roundup, which they conducted. So Marcus, when I met him, had just, I think, you know, a few weeks prior to that meeting, had just been arrested and put on tag, which is where you are, you're basically, you're freed on bail, but with an electronic tag around your ankle. And he was in a bail hostel in Dagenham. And, you know, I got talking and said, do you want to make a film? And he was with Curtis, of course, another childhood friend of Mark Duggan. And their first response, interestingly enough, was that actually, yes, we're interested in making a film, but we thought we'd like to make a drama based on our experiences growing up on the Bullwood Farm estate with Mark.
Okay.
And you know, I explained to them, well, you know, I said, well, two things. A, I do documentaries. I don't do dramas. And B, given the circumstances of your lives currently and what you've been going through over the last year and what you're still going through now, don't you think there's enough drama going on in your own lives? And I think at that point they both said, well, yeah, you might have a point there. And, you know, we agreed to start making an observational documentary from that point.
Were you kind of committed to go as long as it took, or did you have a kind of an end goal in mind? Because obviously, an inquest like that can take years sometimes. Did you have an idea of what the film would be from the start, or were you just kind of willing to be in there as long as it took until kind of it resolved itself and then the film took shape?
I think the latter. I was willing to be in there for as long as it took. There was a thought that maybe this film, you know, it might be something that could be a film that could be made in a few months' time, because when we started filming, there was a thought that the Mark Duggan inquest was going to happen in 2012.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the, again, when I started filming, you know, Mark was, could have been sent to prison at any point. I mean, we thought, we were confident, we had about 3 or 4 weeks of filming with him before he'd be sentenced. That turned into 3 months. The Duggan inquest didn't happen for another 2 years. You know, so initially I thought it might be a film that might, you know, we might have concluded filming.
Yeah.
You know, within a few months from when we started in July 2012. But of course, that wasn't the case, and it did become very much a long form film. You filmed over a long period of time, a film that took a long time to get funding in place, and took quite a long time to get a real sense of what this film was going to be, sort of, you know, from a creative point of view, what the focus of it was going to be, which was, you know, very much an observational documentary, really following these two individuals, Marcus and Curtis. The childhood friends of Mark Duggan, and through their sort of story and what they go through, really sort of, you know, reflecting on the bigger story of what happened to their friend Mark Duggan and, you know, everything that sort of sprang out of that.
Yeah, because the film really kind of, you know, the events of, you know, kind of Mark Duggan's death and then the inquest, they're kind of the central narrative for the film. But the film is so much... It's about so much more, and it's about kind of, and it kind of really kind of spreads out into these wider contexts without ever being preachy or overbearing. You know, it's really subtle the way it kind of touches on a lot of kind of social issues. I mean, from a filmmaking point of view, how useful was it to have this kind of central narrative to be able to move away from and kind of come back to in terms of structuring the film?
It was very important, but it was something that happened organically. I've said that observational documentary was the target. Probably what I should have said was observational documentary was the default.
Yeah.
And I think because of maybe, you know, the background that I've come from in filmmaking, I went to the National Film and Television School, and I was taught by the likes of Nick Broomfield and Kim Longinotto, you know, celebrated documentary, observational documentary filmmakers whose method is to, you know, follow a story and follow people with their cameras, and in some ways, you know, often sort of allow the story to evolve.
Yeah.
So when I started, I didn't necessarily have a story in mind, but I knew that I didn't know where the story was going, but I kind of knew where it had come from, if you like, and I knew what it was at the time when I was filming, which was, you know, there was these two chaps who. You know, were a child who were childhood friends of Mark, and one of them was you know, almost like the forgotten man, because you know, after the sort of media circus kind of left town, if you like,
yeah,
around Mark Duggan and the riots, you know, you had this chap, in a dingy bail hostel in Dagenham, who the media were totally uninterested in, and you know, who I thought, well, you know, this is this calls to mind their quote from Martin Luther King, and that quote is that a riot is a language of the unheard, and that quote actually became a sort of guiding light and creatively for how we should approach the film. And that we should really just hear from these guys, the people who potentially really had a genuine reason, perhaps for writing. You know, not the people who got a message on their BlackBerry and decided that, well, since the police are not intervening, we've got a chance to get some free goods from Foot Locker or JD Sports. Mm. These are people who grew up with Mark Duggan on the Bullwater Farm estate and in a community that had these have a history of these unfortunate interactions with the police and with riots going back to the 1980s, going back to the 1985 Broadwater Farm riot. And you know, with that Martin Luther King quote of mine, the film really became just about them and about their voice. And, you know, that, as I said, that became sort of, you know, the guiding light, creatively speaking, of how to approach the film.
Just a quick reminder that you can contact the Cinematologists on social media. We are on Twitter @Cinematologists, on Facebook /Cinematologists. You can also email us @Cinematologists@gmail.com. We really do appreciate it when listeners find the time to share the episodes via their own networks. And also to disseminate the podcast further, it's great when people leave us an iTunes review. All you do is go over to the iTunes page and look for the Cinematologists there. And you can write a little review, hopefully telling everyone how much you enjoy listening to the podcast and giving us 4 or 5 stars. And now back to Neil with George and Punsar.
It's really interesting because British cinema has kind of had a few examples of, you know, what you might term characters like Curtis and Marcus in dramas, you know, particularly kind of gritty urban London dramas. But they've rarely had that kind of space in a documentary. And I think that that observational approach really allows them the opportunity to reveal their complexity as human beings. And throughout the film, it really, one of the strongest things is the way just the form allows you to realize the complexity of these issues. And that, and it makes you question what the media or what society or what these kind of, you know, the powers that be would term good or evil, and really kind of breaks down that binary and allows them to be people, which I think is quite remarkable. I just wondered how they, you know, because obviously they allowed you the access, and I wonder if the kind of the amount they trusted you sort of changed throughout the film. There's a really interesting, I don't know if I'm reading it wrong, but there's a scene sort of where Marcus is about to go to prison, and he goes to the Enterprise Center, and you get the sense that there were limits to where you could go, or, you know, where the community would allow you. And I wondered if that was a fair reflection, and if you found that changed the longer you spent kind of trying to tell their story.
Yeah, it did change. You know, to begin with, I think they were very wary and you know, cautious.
Yeah.
In terms of trusting someone with a camera, because that's basically what I was, you know. I didn't know what I said. As far as I'm concerned, you know, they had every reason to be distrustful, especially bearing in mind how the media had
represented them, yeah.
The story, you know, from the outset. You know, the initial reports were that Mark Duggan was involved in a shootout with the police. And, of course, that was retracted a few days later, but by then it was too late. You know, that sort of, that image had already lodged itself in people's minds, I think. You know, I think also the Duggan family had journalists from various newspapers, tabloids, what have you, who had sort of, you know, come to their home shortly after Mark was killed and had been invited in for cups of tea. And then, of course, you know, the family had to see some quite horrendous stories in the press soon after that, you know, and we're talking about people in, you know, in shock and, in, you know, bereaved, recently bereaved. So I think given those experiences, I think, you know, unsurprisingly, Marx and Curtis were wary. And I think it was just a process of time. And I think over the months, they realized that I was, I guess I was what I said I was, which was, you know, an independent filmmaker who wanted to make a long-form observational documentary. And certainly by, you know, a year later, when I was still there, you know, they could see I was for real. They might have thought I was slightly crazy. But, considering, you know, I was, for the first year, we didn't have any funding for the film. We didn't have the support that eventually came in from the likes of the Sundance Documentary Institute, from the Bertha Foundation, and from the British Film Institute.
Yeah, great. Just a couple more questions, if that's all right.
Of course.
You mentioned sort of Kim Longinotto, who we've also had on the podcast, and this episode is kind of is centered around Penny Baker and Hedges's The War Room. You know, kind of another great observational documentary. I just wondered what your kind of guiding lights in observational documentary have been over your career, and if there's any kind of particular films that kind of lit a fire and made you think, yeah, this is a way of telling stories that I feel really kind of comfortable with and gravitated towards.
It's Kim Longinotto, definitely, who a mentor for me, and also a teacher at the film school, and Nick Broomfield. Werner Herzog, certainly. You know, I think that the penny really started to drop when I saw films like Grizzly Man, because I thought what really started to become clear was that, you know, there's a way of telling stories with documentaries where you're really approaching it in many ways as you would a conventional drama, if you like, and, you know, the three-act structure and set up conflict resolution and character arcs and narrative arcs and all of those things, I think, that you would associate with cinema being applied to documentary storytelling. So those would be, I think, would be some great influences, as well as the likes of John Acomfora and the Maisels brothers. Mm-hmm. So quite a few.
Yeah.
Few influences there.
Yeah, it's interesting to sort of to you mentioned Herzog there, because and in that context, because that was going to be kind of my sort of last point and question, really, was that there are a lot of moments in the Hard Stop where, you know, you almost kind of break that observational style to really kind of frame and shoot Marcus and Curtis, but also the space and that urban environment really beautifully and really cinematically. And it almost kind of elevates the film. Well, it does elevate the film, you know, beyond the very, very specific context to suggest that these are wider, more universal issues. I wondered how important and vital you think filmmaking can be in terms of highlighting these kind of both very personal stories, but also these kind of systematic issues that the film is so deftly kind of aware of and kind of attuned to?
I'd like to think it is, but in some ways, you know, that's, I guess, the reason why I'm a filmmaker is just from my own personal experience of, you know, becoming, enraptured by that experience of seeing things in, you know, on a big screen in a darkened room or on a small screen, in a living room. it's just you hope that the same effect it's had on you would be the same effect it might have on other people, and I know that my experience of making The Hard Stop, to begin with, I found Broadwater Farm I found to be quite a foreboding place. All I really had to go on was the image I had of it based on what I remember as a kid from 1985 and the riots that happened there. And, you know, as a kid growing up in West London, I remember kind of thinking, well, thank God I don't have to live there.
Yeah.
And you know, after making the film and, you know, getting to know Marcus and Curtis and filming with them observationally, you know, I started to have a different view of the place because, you know, what other people might consider as somewhere they wouldn't ever want to have to live. You know, Marcus and Curtis, for Marcus and Curtis, it's home, and home is where the heart is. And, you know, I could see for them, and Marcus actually said, there's a scene in the film where I think Marcus says this, it's like a, you know, it's a sanctuary.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to try and find some way to portray that visually. And, you know, there's one moment in the film where, which, you know, we shot a sequence of sort of, you know, tracking shots through Broadwater Farm at night, through their estate. And that's immediately dissolved into images of the Houses of Parliament. And, you know, whether or not that works in viewers' minds or not, you know, well, obviously, you know, what we were trying to convey was this sense of places that are perceived to be, you know, scary places, you know, forbidding places. Well, that's just a point of view, because you go to somewhere like Broadwater Farm and you start talking to them about, you know, the what they consider to be a fearsome gang. And they'll say, well, you know, as far as we're concerned, the biggest gang and the most fearsome gang are the ones who are to be found in the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah.
You know, Downing Street. You know, that's who we're afraid of.
Well, I think the film really, really, you know, kind of covers all those things really sensitively and really beautifully. I think it's a great film, and I hope that, you know, you're kind of getting the kind of response that you want when you sort of take it out, and that more people come across it.
Definitely. Thanks very much, Neil.
No, it's a pleasure. So that was my chat with George, and yeah, I mean, you know, of the people that I've managed to interview through kind of the guest lecture program and the podcast, that was one of my favourites. There was something about watching that film and talking to him which really, again, kind of inspired me. I think maybe because of the timing of seeing it, but yeah, I just wondered what you sort of made of the chat, and obviously you saw the film as well, so you know.
Yeah, it was really an impressive piece of work, actually, and it was an impressive piece of work because there were so many traps it could have fallen down, I thought. You know, the two characters at the center, Curtis and Marcus, you know, they could have really easily become kind of stereotypes. And I'm sure there will be certain people who kind of look at them as stereotypes, but that observational style really, really suited the film, I thought. And there was obviously a sort of really important sort of directorial position that George Amponsah was taking in relation to these two guys. And, you know, there was clearly a lot of work would have had to have been done to gain a level of trust that was going on here and get the kind of authenticity that was there. And I thought one of the traps it could have fallen into was being a kind of liberal apology, you know, saying, well, you know, here are these guys that have had such a hard life, and therefore that hard life means that everything that's happened to them is kind of like not their fault. But it really did show some of the real problematic aspects, especially when it went away from the observational style and cut to the riots themselves. I mean, there was some of that CCTV footage of, you know, the kids robbing other kids on the street. It was just like horrific. But nor was it a kind of sensationalist benefit street dog whistle kind of approach either. It did settle back into a thoughtful rhythm, and the sort of use of music and the editing in and out was, you know, a very calm, kind of collected style, I think, and allowed you to explore what was going on without being didactic or giving answers. Because, I mean, one of the elements as well where Marcus is looking towards religion, you know, as a way out, looking towards Islam. And then the film didn't portray it in this way, but then I automatically kind of had that feeling of, well, this is why, you know, the problems in the inner cities is why we have a kind of possibility of a breeding ground for radical ideas and what have you. And then suddenly my liberal guilt kicked in and said, well, no, obviously that you can't just kind of say that. Is that my prejudice and liberal sensibility was kind of guarding against that? So it really sort of asks a lot of complex questions of the viewer, I think. And it was obviously a sense of the poverty and the lack of escape really kind of came through quite strongly.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, interesting to watch it and think, wow, this feels like an observational documentary in the style of of Pennybaker and Hedges or Kim Longinotto, you know, and the Maisels, and you know, when he was kind of talking about that, it was one of those gratifying occasions where someone sort of mentions those kinds of films, and you don't feel like maybe that's a stretch. You know, you felt like actually, yeah, this film feels like someone who has absolutely purposefully chosen that mode and understands the mode and is committed to the mode, you know, not using the tricks of observational documentary, but actually kind of committing to observe as long as it takes. And like you say, kind of take that distance back and not necessarily guide what's being shot, you know. And I think that's why the editing is so strong, because there's the sense of that what's being shot is a filmmaker trying, is acknowledging subjectivity and trying to keep it as objective.
Yeah, and it's just because of the, obviously, the dedication over a number of years, there's a payoff in little moments that last maybe 10 seconds, like when, you know, when he's in the car going to prison and, you know, the tears are rolling down and, you know, the enormity of that. And then the real kind of anger towards the end when the decision comes down that he was unlawfully killed, and but yet no one is going to be convicted. And it ties into that very simple end titles, you know, I'm not going to give it away, but just sort of putting into context in statistical terms, you know, what has been going on with these prisoners or the people who've been taken into custody, and the number of them that have been killed over a, you know, a period of time. And it really made me think actually about the philosophical idea of when personal responsibility comes to bear, and the absolute impossibility of being able to pinpoint the moment where, like, so say you've got somebody who's a kid and has had a hard life, you know, maybe the parenting wasn't great, maybe the education wasn't great, they've been born into poverty. And you could say that they're a product of that environment, whether it's gangs and all that kind of thing as well. At what moment does that move away from being a product of your environment to you have personal responsibility over your own actions? It's really impossible to pinpoint a moment when that, you know, you can say it's not one, it's the other. And so these kind of things are such complex, interrelated issues. Like I say, I think the film doesn't really shy away from the complexity and asking the audience to sort of to engage with these difficult questions, to which there really aren't black and white answers.
That might be why I found it kind of so refreshing, because we live in an age where, you know, opinion is screamed at us. You know, someone's opinion is screamed at us in order for us to acknowledge that opinion and agree with that opinion. And here was a film that trusted that the audience would be able to discern the complexities that were being kind of portrayed. It was interesting, George did a talk for students here, and so, you know, I sort of asked about the audience, because it felt like a film that required a kind of a cinematic engagement which was kind of rare for these kind of subjects, and that these kind of people were not always portrayed in this kind of form. And he was very open and about it, saying that this was made for, you know, for middle class white people.
Oh, really?
You know,
that's interesting.
You know, in the sense that he understands, you know, obviously he wanted Marcus and Curtis to approve and appreciate, and that he'd, you know, and feel like he'd been respectful and had kind of done their humanity justice. But really, it was about kind of taking it out to people who, yeah, have a kind of a literacy in this kind of stuff, and just to kind of, yeah, almost, you know, leave it on the doorstep.
Yeah, and I think it's the kind of film I think that really would benefit from being out on the sort of independent cinema circuit with George there, or with somebody there who can talk about these issues. Because, you know, we're always talking about the state of cinema in terms of, you know, multiplexes versus independent cinemas, and the things that we are always hearing and reading about is that idea that the film is no longer enough anymore. But maybe that's one of the answers to the way in which films and documentaries can actually have some kind of impact, if they are the starting point of conversation rather than just slotted in with another, you know, set of films. I mean, it's just kind of like, it's almost a sort of film that needs to be kept out of the multi. I know that sounds kind of counterintuitive, but you know what I mean? It needs to sit on its own and be thought of almost kind of as its own artifact. I mean, I don't know if that makes sense at all, but yeah, it's weird.
No, well, it's a piece of cinema, isn't it? It's, you know, and in a way that I think if you were to just stumble across it, you might not necessarily appreciate. I think that it's a very, you know, it's a very subtle and intelligent piece of observational documentary. But because of the nature of the participants, I think it could come across in a different way in a different context. And you know, to go back to what you're saying, that's how I got in touch with George. You know, was seeing on social media that's how the film was being toured, and he's toured it a lot. You know, taking it to a lot of festivals, a lot of cinemas, with doing Q&As. It was interesting. He also said that within the space of a week, he'd screened it in Cairo, where they'd had Arabic subtitles, but he'd also screened it in a village community in Sussex where he'd needed English subtitles because that audience could not understand what, you know. But he was saying that was great. That's the diversity that he wants from the work, and is encouraging and it is exciting because he's out there with the work, and like you say, he wants that work to start a conversation, and he's not interested in how, well, obviously he wants it to be a big conversation, but it's all about having a conversation, and that's why he was so gracious with his time to talk to us. Because, and I think as well, you know, we want to talk about it as a film, you know, which I think is, that's as important. You know, we could sit here and, like you say, we've probably got our opinions about that situation and some of the things in it, but really it's a really interesting piece of work that, you know, needs to be talked about as a film. To go back to what we were saying before about, well, what's the role of cinema? Well, it's great to see artists making thoughtful, intelligent work that really makes you just kind of, even if it just stops you in your tracks and makes you question your own ideas and prejudices and assumptions, hopefully people are reflective and want to reflect on how they've been conditioned to think about things and try and not do that again.
Yeah, definitely a high recommendation. So if you can get to see The Hard Stop, either at the cinema or on DVD, we do recommend that you see that. So,
it's just, and it's apparently it's just come on Netflix as well in the UK. So,
well, there you go. So let's move on to the Q&A with yourself and Kingsley, discussing, of course, The War.
I'm pumped.
Pumped.
Like President Bill Clinton.
It makes you feel hopeful.
Mm.
But also, watching it now, you can't detach it from the moment, and it's quite agonising. But it's a powerful piece of work, you know. And it was one of the things. There's such love and hope in that campaign, and it's just. I think on either side as well, I think, you know, it's one of those things that you're thinking about it from the other side, you know, obviously in this case, in recent events, Hillary's the loser, but there's always another side, and those people are always, they have the same hopes and the same love for their candidate, they believe in it the same way that, you know, you believe it on the other side. And
but that's what I love about the movie, that it shows you, you know, these political operatives on both sides of the campaign and their passion for their candidate. And I think that's what I love about it. It's not an impartial film, and it's an og doc, but it does it in such a, there are some lovely moments in this film and about people's passion and, you know, love and labour and all that stuff invested. I think the thing that really strikes me in this moment is, you know, they're the same messages: economics, education, crime, underrepresentation, change and hope, the change of an existent candidacy, 12 years of the Republicans in that instance, and you know, 8 years of Democrats in a recent election. But I think those things resonate, don't they? And coming back into the room and thinking about, you know, in the end of that movie, we're thinking about victory. And I love it doesn't dwell on that too much. You've got the small state house, which feels funny because it has this resonance of the White House. And then thinking about back, it's almost a back to reality or a bump to reality, isn't it? But it speaks to the moment as much as it did 24 years ago. And I think that's pretty incredible for a documentary that looks, you know, looks aged in places. It's shot on film. It looks very beautiful. But it's just that how that can still resonate, because the messages are exactly the same. And I reckon, if you looked at Primary, a movie from 20 years before that, you'd feel the same way today, you know?
Well, yeah, because, you know, we're big fans of Hunter S. Thompson, particularly kind of Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail. And it was interesting watching it, thinking that the process is the same, the messages are the same. And, you know, the attacks from one side are all about character. And in the winning campaign in 92, they fight back with politics. And that's what Hillary tried to do. She tried to fight back on her character attacks with politics. But we don't live in the same time. We don't, you know, no one, it shifted. You know, the idea that you can keep, you know, appealing to people's kind of sense of decency in terms of the debate has to be about the issues. And that's that kind of, it's quite bittersweet because obviously they stick to, let's, you know, and they it's interesting, they try and get the character thing through the press with the Brazil thing, and they're really pushing that, and there's no give on it, so they have to go back to all the issues.
So many resonances with today, the Pentagon leak, yeah, and the kind of FBI story recently with the Clinton campaign
and the outsourcing campaign. Yeah, of kind of
just astonishing how many resonances there are. And I leaned into you as we were watching it and just said, this is the cast of the West Wing. But also thinking about Carville and Doug Stamper, you know, this fixer, kind of aggressive, thoughtful guy, but these Michael Lewis calls them rented men, you know, these kind of political operatives who may not, they're campaign managers, they're not people who serve in the White House under the presidency often. And I think that's really interesting as well. These people kind of come and go.
Yeah.
And you wonder about how you can be so invested in that. And it is a job, you know, but that you believe.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, the filmmakers obviously are there for that duration, and Clinton disappears from the film as he gets closer to the presidency. At the start, they're all in the room together.
He's in shorts,
phone, yeah. And over the course of that film, he gets further and further away as he gets closer to power, and it is really fascinating the way the film kind of captures that really subtly. Mm. You know, there's no voiceover, there's no titles. It's just like,
yeah, you're right. There's a moment where the Secret Service kind of emerge in the movie. They must have been there prior to that. It must be after. No, it's after he wins the candidacy, isn't it? But
yeah,
after that moment, you start to see the bubble, don't you? There's a couple of astonishing scenes where you see the limousines and all those, again, machinations of state or statehood.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's not just the West Wing, is it? It is kind of House of Cards, scandalous. And I think what is, they all owe a debt to this film. They are all, the people who create those films obviously love this film because it drips with the same feeling that this film does. But having sort of rewatched Don't Look Back recently, and Pennebaker particularly is kind of interested in it's not interested in the pageantry. You know, Don't Look Back, there's 12 minutes of music in it, and it's a concert film. You know, he's interested in about the other stuff. And this film is, you know, there is a bit of that, but it's really not about that. You know, I think there's a genuine interest in how does this stuff happen, which everybody sees. You know, we see on the news, we see the kind of the waving on the stage, but how do those people get on that stage in the first place, and what are they like away from it? And it's a really kind of powerful film in that sense, because it set up the last kind of 20 years of American TV.
Having watched it fairly recently, certainly in the last 6 months, but sitting here and I'm absolutely drawn in by the filmmaking, and wonderful on the big screen as well. I've only ever seen it.
Yeah, it's really a beautiful film to fall into.
What do you think about the distinction between this? The documentary take, the ideas of actuality and fictional representations, and where the power lies there. That this story has been well told, and we're familiar with the news footage and things from fictional recreations of that, or things like House of Cards, and how this stands to that in storytelling terms.
He talks about the kind of the labour, you know, and you can't watch this film and not feel like it's a job, you know. And I think that when it's fictionalised, a lot of that kind of the banality of it is taken away. You know, these, and they look tired throughout the film, and you can tell, you know, and they look worried, you know, and not for dramatic effect, but genuinely because it shifts across the course of the film. There's a real interest in, like you say, these people who do this job, you know, that put themselves under immense pressure and are essentially responsible for, you know, Clinton getting the presidency. You can't, you know, they control everything and they manage everything. It's a multifaceted job, and it doesn't look very glamorous. And I think, you know, that those final shots are so brilliant, you know, because it's like that's just an empty room, and you know those people in that room are not going to the White House. That's why it works, because the distance that the filmmakers have is
they never flip over. You know, it would have been so easy, I think, to kind of to skewer that towards the candidate, you know, and they're not interested in that because for them it's not about, it doesn't seem like it's about him. It's about this process and the machinery of the campaign, which is obviously worked on by just kind of just people, you know. And he I think obviously it's looking back on it, he's not a person now. You know, when you're a president, you're not a person anymore, really. You know, you're this kind of figure, this idea. And it is interesting to see the kind of, be reminded of the people that kind of left behind almost by that shift.
There's some things that, in retrospect, I think there's been some seismic shifts. You know, I said about social media earlier on, but also in polling. Mm. There's some moments here where polling is so important to them. And I feel, as I'm sure a lot of pollsters do, undermined by that recently in recent elections, both in the States, in the UK, prior to Brexit as well, where the polling was not as expected, and that there's been a lot written around that about unexpected voters and those kind of things. And I find that fascinating in the film, that some things which you think would be pretty static or unmoving, here they feel... Well, we kind of know, or I feel like as a member of the audience, I know a bit, but you don't trust those polls. You know, I'm thinking that all the way through.
Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a film that makes you realise how important the press is, or was. Everything in that film is geared towards message. Then the press are the conduit to get that message out there. So be it creating a TV spot to get on, you know, or to be it kind of the papers or 10 minutes here or 10 minutes there. It's kind of, how do we get our message out through this conduit? And there's this kind of unseen power of the press. Whereas now, and we know from this position of watching it in 2016, that's redundant now, because the president just ignores the press, absolutely ignores, and just tweets and has his, you know, puts it on Facebook, and can lose 4 debates on national television horrifically, not even speaking in full sentences, and still be elected because he's removed that power, which is kind of in here so intrinsic to how they can't do it. They can't do it any other way. That's the machine, and they absolutely rely on that, and it's kind of the center of the film in terms of how do we, and they fight it the whole time because in terms of they feel hard done by. And you were talking before about the idea of the left and people sort of, you know, students. Oh, it's horrible, and suck it up. And then Carville's in there going, oh, they don't listen to us. You know, they don't take the, you know, it's, you know, because they don't, the left has no money. The right controls the media, always has done, buys that space, you know, leads that agenda. And now they're kind of out of the equation because social media has kind of meant that they don't need to be there anymore. It's interesting to watch it.
There's a couple of funny things in the movie. One is at the end where, it's kind of said to Clinton, we've got to do it now. We've got to really do it. And I think that's interesting because I think with Trump, those campaign promises are starting to drift away. And we've seen that in Brexit as well. But here, that guy who's so close to then Governor Clinton and then at the end of the movie, President-elect, there's a moment again, and I don't know whether that's recent circumstances or in the rewatching, because I've always felt invested in this film and invested in what Clinton offered at that time. And but even there, this guy so close to it is saying, you know, all that stuff we said, we've actually got to go through with it now. But this was a president who came close to impeachment.
Yeah.
And then wrestles with his reputation. And Hillary Clinton has had to fight that as a presidential nominee as well. And all that stuff, after watching the movie, it exudes something, a resonance in history, you know.
Yeah.
I find that really an odd feeling.
And I think it's weird, isn't it? Because it's obviously, it doesn't feel like it's partisan because of where it's positioned, but it doesn't feel like Pennebaker and Hedges are kind of, you know, tooting the horn for the guys, you know. But obviously, they're just there. They get the chance to shoot a campaign, and it's a, you know, it's the kind of candidate that would be welcome that, you know, and understand the value of that. So they've got this record, which then history has kind of, with each passing year, it seems, made more and more resonant. It's kind of what I was talking about before. We need this stuff because going back to it is as important as watching it in 93, going, oh, isn't it great? You know, this guy's in. And now there's so much context every time you watch it. It's, you know, it's important, I think, to kind of go back and remember, actually. And then, like you say, that guy is hope, that he wants that hope that the whole campaign has been built on to be realised, but knowing that he won't have any influence in it. He was the campaign guy.
Yeah,
you know, it's
basically, for me, it's about thinking about towards the end of the Obama presidency as well, about 8 years of a Democrat who, you know, based on change, and that word comes up, hope and change come all the way through this film. And Clinton was that person, you know, after 12 years of Republicans, post-Gulf War and all that stuff. Obama carried that as well, post 8 years of Bush, Iraq and Afghanistan, 9/11, and you know, that kind of investment. And I, thinking back to that election only 7.5 years ago, 8 years ago, I'm thinking about that and how invested I was in that. And it's a powerful feeling, isn't it, for an election that I don't vote in, you know, that I'm not a citizen in that country, but the global implications of these campaigns, as you say, driven by money and vested interest, which you do not see in this movie. You know, they stick to messaging where you don't see lobbyists outside the campaign or any of that stuff, which is also fascinating because it's an omission.
Yeah.
You know, it's not there, and it's really, really important that the Clinton campaign and the amount of money raised to make this happen is not evident at all, because it's about, as you said, it's about people's jobs and a job of work.
But that stuff, you know, that stuff is conspicuous by its absence if you are invested in that, you know, that, and I think that's where the viewer brings something to it, you know, when you ask that question, well, why, where is this stuff? And by not going after it, it's kind of making almost a point.
It's not beauty, but these filmmakers as well, that they, you see them find the subjects almost. You see the camera move around these spaces and find the people they're going to gravitate around. And to me, that's great documentary filmmaking, that you don't know what story is going to emerge. And like I said, they didn't have a great deal of access here. Mm. They didn't shoot a lot of footage. And you wonder, I'd love to see the other 30 hours or so of the footage that they did capture and wonder how revelatory that is. Because there are sequences within this movie that help tell the story.
Yeah.
But I find that's a mastery of documentary filmmaking. I think it's immensely powerful.
Great. Okay, so let's open it out to our audience.
I think something that's always really important about documentaries, especially observational actuality, is that as an audience, you look for something to ring true. And in this documentary, I think the truth that comes across is that these people that are running the campaign are very complex and experience very intense emotions very quickly. They go from quickly hardballing something to manipulation of the press, you know, when he's talking, saying this could ruin your career, to suddenly a very emotional moment, which you actually connect with and you think, wow, they've worked really hard. And I think this also translates through their need to assassinate character, that they're so involved in this, and we only see a small part of their lives, but it's so intense for them and it's everything. They're so involved in character assassination. And in the documentary, we very rarely hear them talk about what actually Bill Clinton is standing for, the differences he's going to make. And I think that rings really true to Hillary's campaign. There was so much celebrity culture going out with celebrities, you know, Instagram posts. There were almost webisodes of things where celebrities were talking about, you know, Trump's bad behavior and things like that, that we lost what she actually stood for. And because I think they're so involved in that, we know that they are committed to a point where they're lost almost. And then when it comes through, you see this joy and you really relate, but you know they've almost gone about it a really inhumane way.
There's a real tragedy to it, I think. And I think that there's something Neil was saying earlier on about living a good life, you know, that this is where we are. And I don't quite know how we've got here, but that Sunning the President book with Nixon is really, really important. Nixon won by a landslide in 72, where there were already doubts about his presidency, where there was so much stuff wrapped up in that. And we see with Clinton here, we know in retrospect what Clinton was as a person, as a president, and what happened afterwards, which is bad, you know. And you're right, I think it's that, are they cold emotionally, these characters? Where do their morals sit here? That they're doing this as a job of work, it's very well paid. And as you say, the way that they move around this, they seem, you warm to some of the characters, but in others, these are bare threats, aren't they? Career-ending threats down the phone. And caught by the documentary team, and no one blinks about that stuff. And you wonder, you say they're complex, and they are, because we're not normally faced with characters like that in life, because these are very, very unusual people in a very, very unusual position. And you wonder, with these kind of, that rented men, these political operatives, what are they? I think of Duck Stamper, you know, in House of Cards, that they're murderers and thieves, you know, and liars, but they're doing it with purpose. I think you're right. It's complex.
It is, and I think that, you know, the filmmakers aren't, they don't let everything play out. They move on very, you know, the film rattles along. They really get into that sense of how quickly things move and how a lot of that is left in the air, as you say, because they move on to something else. But the film never resolves. So even if those things are resolved, the film doesn't resolve them. The film moves on. And that's a feature of Pennebaker going back, you know, that it's about momentum, and it's about kind of almost making the audience raise question after question after question and not giving them any answers. It's almost pushing the engagement of the audience in those questions about these people that they're shooting. So it's observational in terms of shooting it, but the editing it isn't, doesn't always feel like we're given the chance to really work out how these things end. And that leaves almost a bad taste in the mouth, because you're like, well, is there a responsibility to know what happens, you know? And but obviously the accumulative effect is actually, no, this is the politics of it. This is how it goes. And I think that there, you know, that process of it has kind of consumed the plots. I think, you know, you're right, there's a lot of stuff that is not, we never really know about Clinton. And then he, like you say, gets further and further away from the film.
I think that's the issue I have with political biopics, that they have to resolve themselves. Mm. So they explain behaviour, often through fictionalisation or, you know, the connection of dots in character, and often after the characters are dead. While here, Clinton's still alive, we know what his legacy is, and the people that helped get him elected. And I think it's a really interesting observation, because I said earlier on, maybe, you know, what's the difference between the fictionalisation of these stories and the documentary? And I think you've nailed it. It's human complexity and how we... I was excited. My heart was racing at the end, you know, and I feel for them when they're giving that lovely speech at the end about how people have invested in the campaign, and you think, yeah, all that stuff you did on the way, it was worth it, right? But from what you've said, thinking about it, what was it worth it? And what have you sacrificed in terms of a sense of what is right to get the candidate elected?
But I think the film makes it clear, doesn't it, kind of very subtly, that the campaign and the presidency are not connected. The room at the end is a kind of statement of that. Like, there's a clean slate now. And Stephanopoulos keeps saying, you know, right at the end, like, the point that this won't happen overnight, you have to make that clear up front. You have to say that up front, because everything we've talked about goes out the window. We've said what we've said to get to this position. The position is different, you know, and that I think that is something that we have learned. And that's, you know, it's what you were saying earlier about Trump. That's what he started to do, because you can say what you want to get in there, but you can't. It's going to have to be a different story in there to a certain degree, you know, in terms of backtracking or not being able to do the things that you say, because it's not really about the policies. It's about more and more about character and personality. And we were talking about the New Yorker Radio Hour and the conservatives sort of talking about that you're not elected on the policies. You're elected on, you know, a variety of other things, which are mainly about, do people trust you or believe you, or are they interested in you? And, you know,
it's amazing in a mediated age where we know so much about the candidates, and we get a sense of their lives, and their history is well recorded, particularly in the presidency, where there's a kind of almost an audit of every candidate, and that stuff is reported to us. And yet, why we think that's so important, when what we'd like to see is a legacy that we can invest in, because that's what politics should be about, right? You vote for people you believe to do things that are right for you and the people around you and your family or community, or your kind of moral beliefs and investment. And yet we seem, and I mean us in the room, feel like that's okay to be cheated every time, because there seems to be no other course of action. And when we were talking about post-US election earlier on, just who does represent me and those other people? And this idea of, not everybody in America is either a Clinton or a Trump voter, and yet the presidency comes down to this binary where there's lots of people who were neither. And that's a question that isn't resolved either. Certainly not in this film, but in any political film, really.
No, I think it's a reminder of a time that we've moved past culturally, but we haven't acknowledged politically, which is that if there ever was a time when there was a kind of a two-party politics in terms of, that age is gone. I think that the age that we live in terms of the individualized culture of people, it can't come down to that binary anymore, and I think it could for a while in terms of that was the best workable system. But now we certainly don't live in that age where one candidate can represent, on either side. So it'd be interesting to see where, if politics will ever kind of move with the culture in that way, or the culture will go back. I think it's who knows?
So one thing that struck me was, especially, I think Libby just said it, that you sort of don't know what the policies are, especially with this film. It's more about the people behind the scenes and making sure that the message is going out to the people that their person is going to do good for them. But I suppose it's the same for any election that I've been alive for and can remember. It's always that things are bad now, and this is the person that's going to make it better. And then 4 years later, things are still bad. This other person's going to make it better again and again and again. And it's kind of like the people behind the scenes truly believe in the movement. You could see like how emotional, I think it's James, was he called? And what a great bloke he was as well. You could see how emotional he was, because he thought he was going to do something that was going to be great for the people, that was going to be good for his children, his grandchildren. He was going to create jobs, create wealth, and help the people most in need. And then 4 years later, you've probably got someone else thinking that they can do just the same. And people always looking for a candidate, I think, will like Kingsley just said, leave a legacy. And, I don't think many candidates have left legacies apart from Reagan with Reaganomics, and nothing else is, it's always bad and it's always going to get better under this person.
It's easy to say change, right?
Yeah.
But it's difficult to affect
because
that change.
All the candidates seem to stand for at the moment is re-election, and Obama's was yes, we can. It's almost like Bob the Builder, and Donald Trump is make America great again. In a way, he still hasn't described exactly how he's going to do it. And Hillary Clinton is much the same. It was less about her policies and more about her persona.
Wasn't her slogan, I'm with her?
Yeah, it was, I'm with her. So it's saying the people are with her, but with her doing what?
I think that is a shift that we've seen. I mean, the film foregrounds the shift very well, because the first thing that Clinton has to deal with is this kind of character, the affair question. That's what did him in the end, was his character, and that's what they were waiting for. They knew that at some point in his presidency, he would slip up in that way. And I think that you look back at his record, and he did some great things, domestically. And he was great. His involvement in the Northern Ireland peace process was brilliant. He also did some terrible things in the Balkans, but what he actually did as a president is no one talks about. No one talks about the good stuff or the bad stuff. It's that, it comes down to that celebrity kind of moment. Obama's kind of the same, really. That his record is, his moves in the economy have been fantastic, despite the American press saying that, it's the worst it's been in 20 years, which is just a lie. He has improved the economy. He has improved jobs. He does have a very troubled and problematic history of drone attacks in the, but he'll be remembered as a cool president who went on Marc Maron and did memes and stuff like that, because that's where the narrative ends. It's hard if you're interested or believe in politics to find a way through it, because so much of it is not about policy. I think the film's very prescient about capturing a time when that starts to, you know, with the, you know, this is obviously 92, there's no internet, you know, but you get the sense of a shift in what is going to be talked about just through what they've captured, you know, and they've not, you can tell they've not gone after it because it's such a beautifully edited piece of work, but that, you know, like that falls in their lap, you know, this kind of scandal that is at the start of the campaign, so it's at the start of the film, and it does cast a shadow over everything, and it's since cast a shadow over his presidency, and it's difficult, isn't it, to because it comes down to who are these people and what are they like, and it, you know, like you said, that's not what you want it to be about. You want it to be about changing people's lives and having a fairer society and kind of, yeah, not being about who do we prefer personally.
But that's the fascinating thing about running for election, that the actually what unites people is everybody cares for their children, right? And everybody believes in criminal justice systems and healthcare and an improved economy and a better life for people's children. Everybody believes in that stuff. And what's interesting about this film is you see this divergence between these two candidates, when in fact much of what they're saying on the stump is very similar. You couldn't say that Bush wasn't about the economy, you know, that there was a tracking of his record in a difficult period in American history post Reagan that doesn't play well for him, or he didn't remove Saddam Hussein from power, but Saddam Hussein had invaded Iraq. Kuwait, rather, and that there was a reaction to that and some form of victory, you know. And I think it's incredibly difficult that I was talking to Neil earlier on about 13th, which I watched yesterday, thinking about this, and again thinking about the power of documentary to almost reinforce things that you know, to take you behind certain things. And 13th does it through statistics, doesn't it? It kind of shows this motif of the criminalization, partly through race, but through policy. And Clinton pops up in there, as do many politicians from the 60s, kind of, or from the 50s, in fact, onwards. But I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's difficult, because the policy things are just stump moments, aren't they? These three things, you have them on. In fact, they're mentioned at the start of this film, and then they're mentioned at the end, in that we see it on the board from that abandoned empty room, about economy, don't forget healthcare. You know, I don't know what the answer is to it.
But again, because we're not politicians, you know, we're film people, aren't we? You know, and but also citizens of the world. And it's difficult sometimes, you know, to not feel like you should be more of a citizen, because it just feels quite hopeless a lot of the time. You know, when a film like The War Room still sits there and you can go back to it. And I think the same, you know, watching 13th, it was the same, thinking like, God, how is this happening? You know, and knowing that actually, yeah, in this film will sit there like The War Room sat there. And in 20 years time, it'll be gone back to. And hopefully things will be better, but it will contain a lot of things that you just are not. It takes time for this stuff to have a, you know, have an impact. I don't know. It's
maybe the thing that is done is the making of the work, right? Mm. That the work sits there. The War Room is sat on the iPlayer for the last year as part of a Storyville strand, a slightly compressed theme. 13th sits on the very front page of Netflix, and you know, again, many of my students have watched that film recently and talked to me about it, and I've, you know, that's great that those messages are communicated by filmmakers, and it forms part of the legacy, doesn't it? That this film is a document of the Clinton campaign and says something about it and of American politics 25 years ago and probably 50 years ago and, you know, yeah, more recently as well.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming out to see the film. Hope haven't left you too depressed. But I think I think that was, you know, what you sort of said at the end, I think is important, isn't it? That we do the work and it's conscious, you know, we're woke, and, you know, to use that kind of hip hop terminology, and we're making conscious work which tries to communicate the struggle of being alive and trying to get through the world and kind of then kind of coming together to share it. I think that is, it has a value, and I think that we often forget that, and it's easy for people to sneer at that and say, oh, you're just making movies or you're just writing, or, you know, but it's like, no, this is this is how we navigate through it, and this is what we're deciding to do. We could do more, but we're starting with a film screening and a talk about stuff that matters, and not feel, and we feel, I feel less alone than I did before. I think that is important. So
Carville says the second most important thing you can give is your labour, right?
Yeah. And when you find that labour of love, you know, and I think that's what we're in, isn't it? We make stuff, we teach stuff, we definitely feel it. And it's trying to find a way to keep that positive and have an impact and feel the impact from people, you know, who you kind of come into contact with, who are an age removed from you, but going to go, but feel the same things and go through the same things and have the same ideas, the same thoughts, the same fears. And yeah, it matters, I think. So there was a lot there that the film kind of threw up. Again, kind of similar to the chat with George, really, was about the filmmaking and the piece of work, as you know, the film as a piece of work. So I just wondered, you know, your response to rewatching it and kind of thinking about it as an observational documentary.
I mean, the first thing that struck me was the grain, I have to say. You know, it just looked like it was shot on something that they picked up. I mean, I don't know if it was digital video, an early sort of form of digital video or something like that, but really sort of positioned it, didn't it, in a kind of, in that 90s context. Despite that, though, the kind of prescience of, you know, what was going on and the way that the Stephanopoulos and Carville were dealing with the issues around organising the people at the bottom, who were just sort of true believers in a sense. And these are these two guys were sort of real, you know, seasoned political hacks in a way. And they knew how the game was played. And I always love, like, political films, like All the President's Men, I always think is the best movie on the phone. So Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman on the phone, it's just riveting stuff. And it was the same here, like Carville, you know, giving someone a dressing down on the phone is just hilariously funny. And then the way that they, like I said before, sort of handle the misinformation about the media and getting really, really sort of frustrated. And it did, obviously, it sort of reminded me of a lot of political films, but I don't know if you've seen this, but it's a documentary series on Netflix, which is produced by CNN called Race for the White House. Yeah, it very much is a sort of very highly produced version of the sort of six different races that are covered. And this is one of them. But it's really fascinating how that kind of insight, I think, is one of the things that you would just never see here anymore. And I know that there was, I mean, for example, there was a documentary about Jeremy Corbyn that followed him around. And it was kind of ridiculed as being something that, you know, only a naive politician would kind of agree to. So there's a sort of, there's a freshness to the film, I think, that comes from an era that's before the overt political spin, you know, that we might associate with the thick of it. It seemed to play still quite well with the students who did come to the screening.
You know, it's made by great filmmakers, you know, and I think it's such a, I talked to my students about kind of academic work, and I think that this holds for those great kind of observational documentaries, is that there's something about a kind of commitment to knowledge and the process, which means that when you edit it down to what the final thing is, what's left out and what's recorded and what's understood has seeped into the work in some way, you know, where it's clear from the War Room that I know that Kingsley also said they haven't got a lot of stuff, but they shot everything they could and then they've constructed it. So the decisions are kind of instinctual in the moment decisions and also editing decisions, you know, and I think that it comes through because there's the sense when you watch the film that this is the best way that this material can be understood and that what is being represented is as coherent and as key as it possibly could be. And I think that, like you talk about the prescience, I think that all the history that we then kind of reverse engineer onto it is possible because of the intelligence of the filmmakers and the intelligence of them as both camera people who are in that moment, and then also as editors. And I think that's, you can't help but respond to that because it's almost a kind of respect for craft and a respect for intelligence, which is the film, it's not really saying anything kind of, it's not loud and brash in terms of what the film is saying, even though Carville is obviously a really interesting, loud and brash character. But it kind of, the filmmakers understand that world that they're in. They respect that world. They have obviously engaged with it in terms of reading about it and seeking to understand it on its own terms in order to be able to represent it.
which is key. And again, I think rare today. I think that, you know, if you don't watch a lot of documentaries, or you watch what we kind of spoke about earlier in terms of more subjective, experimental narrative documentaries, this idea that you can just observe something and represent it as kind of complexly as it does, is, it might be quite, you know, again, you wouldn't think that it'd be something that people hadn't seen before, but maybe people haven't, you know.
I don't think that people are, you know, unless you're sort of steeped in film or documentary, won't be aware of history of the observational style. So going back to people like Robert Drew and Primary and Jean Rauch, you know, who was the instigator of what was known back then as cinema verite. And I think these were very much kind of reactions to the idea that the director was imparting his or her vision on top of what was seen as a kind of realistic document of what was going on. So that was seen as problematic. So the observational style was a sort of attempt to withdraw back to this anthropological, non-invasive form of documentary. And there's huge problems around that, because, you know, as soon as you set a camera down and press record, you're making an editorial and a directorial decision. But I think that the form then was, I mean, I suppose even back then it was a reaction as well to the auteur theory, maybe, of you know, overtly stylized filmmaking, where the personal vision of the director was the thing that you were interested in, where it's trying to remove that. Maybe in the era of the smartphone and the camera phone, in the digital age, where now just pressing record is an easy thing to do, that sense of direct intervention using the camera or the observational style is just something that we all do when we record on our phones. You know, and you can see it in the work of Kim Longinotto, and that film we saw a couple of years ago, Maidan, was another big example of that, I think. And I think maybe it's sort of the two split results of what is happening, or what has happened with documentary, where that sense of the expositional style or the traditional style of documentary no longer can be equated with truth in an unproblematic way. So then you've got the likes of Oppenheimer and Lorraine and people like that who are using documentary in a kind of experimental way and trying to problematize the process of calling it a documentary. And then you've got these observational styles, which are going back to that idea of trying to withdraw the directorial intervention completely by looking at things from afar. So it's really interesting. It's a really interesting kind of culmination of documentary's entire.
Yeah, and I thought that 13th did a really interesting job of highlighting the problematic nature of this stuff in the current era, you know, with the use of that kind of mobile phone footage, the idea of technology being this thing which everyone has access to, which can instantly record an objective reality, has already been completely, you know, manipulated and kind of corroded, because what is seemingly at least enough to instigate a discussion or a judicial process, the recording of an incident, the fact that those incidents are ignored does feed into this idea of what is the camera doing and can it ever record reality? And you think that, well, yeah, documentary has always had a problematic history in terms of objectivity and subjectivity. Now anybody can essentially be a citizen journalist or documentarian, but what they record can still be treated as a fiction or as a kind of a subjective reality, even though you'd think that what is shown isn't. So there's all these kind of contexts are constantly part of the narrative around documentary, and this rise of a more subjective experimental approach is in line with kind of cultural shifts in terms of personal narratives, and in terms of, you know, this, the individualized society that we now live in much more, you know. So
absolutely, but it's also a reaction to the fact that people don't believe video images, or they don't automatically assume that a video image can reflect a documentary truth. In a sense, you know, in another way, you could say this is a sort of crisis for the classical documentary. I know it's a cliche thing to say, but the reaction to it has been interesting in terms of filmmakers who have found a way to interrogate the idea of the process of what documentary traditionally has been expected to do.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, something like The War Room is, it feels like it's from a different time where that kind of access would have been, I don't think necessarily that you wouldn't get that access now, but it would be managed in that way that when journalists are embedded with troops, you know, that the process and the access is kind of managed within an inch of its life, and that people are picked for their subjectivity in order to represent an objectivity. You know, I can't imagine people kind of picking someone like Pennebaker now because knowing the kind of choices that you know. So yeah, like, again, what's changed is not necessarily how these films are made or what they might even be showing is kind of very, very similar, but there's so much underneath the surface that has shifted very slightly, so that we know that the decisions that have gone into allowing this to be captured are very, very carefully managed.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that will just about do it for this episode. So we have one more episode to go, one more taping to go, one more screening to go. There may be an extra bonus episode in there at some point over Christmas, but we do have a exciting film to watch next week, which is definitely going to lighten the mood.
Yes, so we're going all mainstream. We're selling out. We're doing a Christmas movie at Christmas. We are, yeah, kind of playing to the gallery. We are screening Joe Dante's Gremlins, but it's the first time that we're doing an event at the New Lynn Film House, which is this wonderful cinema down here, just outside Penzance in Cornwall. It's a really beautiful cinema. They're really lovely people who run it, so we're really excited to kind of get that collaboration up and running with I think what would just be a fun screening. And I think it's just a nice way to kind of round off, you know, get together, watch a movie, and enjoy a movie. We've got an interview in that episode with Lola Landekic, who is one of the people behind Art of the Title, and she gave a talk last night which was just all these kind of amazing title sequences. And you just watch it and you just realize, wow, movies are great. You know, movies are brilliant. I love movies. We love movies. Sometimes it is important to do what we've done today, which is hopefully reach out a bit further beyond film as entertainment. But sometimes it is important to kind of revel in entertainment and artistry. So hopefully you'll enjoy our Gremlins episode.
So I look forward to seeing you. So I'm going to come down and we're going to do that together.
Yep, can't wait for that.
Thanks once again to our audience. If you do have time, we would love, you know, more of your conversations on social media, on Twitter, despite slagging it off mercilessly. And we'd also, you know, really appreciate any reviews you want to give us on any of the podcast collection or iTunes websites where you can find our podcast. So until next time, this has been the Cinematologist Podcast. Thanks for listening. And the tallest and the biggest one.